supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of those jam-packed shows for you, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll be talking about opossums, those weird little marsupials that you may have thought of as garden invaders. Well, guess what? You might be thinking very differently of them at the end of our hour. We're also going to talk to our good friend, Howard Garrett, the dirt doctor down in Texas, who is advocating using Christmas leftovers to get rid of fire ants. You won't want to miss it. We're also going to take lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
And where is Tom doing great?
In Cedar Hill, Tennessee.
Okay, so you know I have no idea where Cedar Hill, Tennessee is.
Well, it's a small community, about 328 people, about 20 miles north of Nashville.
Okay, so what can we do for Tom in Cedar Hill, just outside of Nashville?
Well, I enjoy listening to you each week, and I've heard you speak often about the raised bed gardens, and I'm interested in trying that, but in a slightly different way. My wife, Michelle, she's a fabulous cook, and she loves using the freshest vegetables and everything she cooks. Plus, we eat a ton of salad.
Right.
So most of the time, we buy this locally, or we get it from a few plants that Michelle keeps on the kitchen counter. But we have this hot tub that's sitting on the deck that we don't use. And instead of getting rid of it, I was thinking of turning this into a little raised bed garden. It's seamless. It's made of fiberglass. It's about 6 feet in diameter, and it's about 2 feet deep. It's in a great location. It faces the west and the south. And get sun practically all day long. I don't think I want to completely fill the tub with soil because it might get too heavy for the deck. I was thinking about putting like styrofoam peanuts in the bottom, but I would thought that the water might just drain to the bottom and then get stagnant. So I was wondering what you thought about this idea about using this, first of all, and if I was to use it, how do I make this work with soil and drainage?
Okay, so this is Cowboy Gardening 101. And it's not going to be raised bed gardening. You're going to create a giant container.
Okay.
Is there anything in the bottom of the tub that can be opened up? Is there a drain in the very bottom?
No.
To make this work well, you're going to have to either cut a panel out of the bottom and install kind of a sewer grating for the water to drain out, or you're going to take a power drill and drill 100 little holes.
Okay. Well,
and
that's a good idea, yeah.
And be aware that the water is going to drain out the bottom of this, but it's sitting on top of a deck, so there's going to be airflow underneath. Okay, so yeah. 2 feet deep and 6 feet around. Can you reach the center by walking around?
Yes.
Now, this is going to be a giant container, and what we fill it with is going to be helpful in terms of the weight. Styrofoam peanuts, I don't like the idea of peanuts in the bottom of it. I think that they would also migrate up.
Okay.
So what I would do is I would find the most lightweight stone I could, and I would put 6 inches in the bottom, and then you're going to make a big investment. You are going to go out, and you're going to find a nursery or a garden center that will sell you bulk professional mix. It's a combination of milled peat moss with enough lime to equal out the acidity, and then a perlite and vermiculite and a little bit of forest products or compost or something like that. And it comes in giant bales that when you wet them, that it increases the size dramatically.
Okay.
If you want to do this right, 6 inches of lightweight stone on the bottom, and on top of that, a 50-50 mix of this professional mix and the best high-quality compost you can find. If the compost makes the mix seem a little heavy when you're starting out, get a couple of big bags of perlite alone. Perlite is a mined volcanic glass sold in huge bags as big as you and I that weigh about 5 pounds. it brings air into the soil. It helps that moisture get through. It'll keep your mix lightweight. And then every year you can add some compost to the top to feed your plants, or you can feed them with a fish and seaweed mix. The only thing I'll add is line it up so that you can run some row covers down the center for your salad greens. You can grow salad greens all winter long. So you'll grow your summertime plants on the outskirts, run salad greens down the center. You should go to town. They'll need to be protected from the summer heat. You may not be able to grow your salad greens in the summer.
Okay.
But you'll grow them all winter long.
Thank you so much, Mike. You have a blessed day. I really appreciate all your help.
All right. Good luck, sir. Great adventure.
Thank you very much.
1-888-346-9499. Deborah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Deb, how are you?
Very good. Longtime follower of the show.
Oh, thank you so much. Ed, we've been around a while. Where are you?
I am in Wagontown, Chester County. Beautiful little village about an hour west of Philadelphia.
Was it named after a happy dog?
No, it was actually named after the Wagon Inn, a very old inn where, who knows, George Washington might have actually made an appearance.
There you
go. A lot of historic structures here.
All right. What can we do for Deb in the Living History Museum of Pennsylvania?
Well, I was given an amaryllis a few years ago, and I've had great success with it. And last year, it multiplied into two bulbs, and each bulb sent up a flower stem, and I had, maybe 15, 20 blooms between the two of them. It was just spectacular.
Congratulations.
Yes, I was, and it's a beautiful striped, red and cream striped variety. So
I knew that one. I know that one. I have a couple of those.
So I took it down to the basement. I had it outside all this year, and it got a lot of nice fronds on it. And then I took it down to the basement, and the fronds died. And course of repotting it, the bulbs had really multiplied. I had two large ones, two medium ones, and one or two little tiny bulblets.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to split them up, and I could not do it. And I just hesitated. I pulled, I pried, I used a fork, I tried to use a knife, and I really hesitated to take a cleaver and just, it just would have hurt my heart. You know what I mean? So I just repotted them, put them up in a sunny window here, and they're all getting fronds, but no bud stems. So I'm just wondering if I did the wrong thing or the right thing.
It may simply have needed a rest. You may not have done anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll go over the basics. The basic rules are after the flowers fade, you clip off the seed head to stop that kind of production, because these things will reproduce by seed and by those little bulbets they form at the bottom. And then typically what happens is the leaves come out. At that point, it is important to feed the bulb.
Oh.
So
when I'm putting it outside for the summer and all the fronds are coming out, you mean?
Exactly. When those leaves...
I guess I do feed it. I can't
When
remember.
Those leaves are starting to get a good size, the bulb needs food, both in the form of sunlight and both in the form of food. So that's a great time to start feeding it a gentle, like compost tea or a soluble organic fertilizer like Half Strength. Then when it goes outside for the summer, then you can really hit it with a nice thing of fish emulsion and seaweed, because you don't care what it smells like. But the one that you only got the leaves on this year, I wouldn't sweat it. I would just follow the drill as if it had flowered and these leaves were following it. So you want to make sure these leaves get a lot of sun, a lot of food, and then maybe, especially because the leaves are out already very early, maybe this is one that you snatch back out of the summertime garden in July and put it in a cool, dark place and make sure it gets a solid 3 months of dormancy. No light other than the weakest ambient light, no food, no water. And then make sure it goes completely dormant. My understanding is 3 months is the minimum, but 4 months is fine. And then typically, if you've gotten it correct, a lot of times, even when you go back to then repot them and reactivate them to get them growing again, you'll see the sign of that very distinctive thing in the center that shows you you've got a flower stalk coming up already.
Now, what about the fact that there's so many bulbs together? Should I, that's not a problem? I don't have to separate them?
A lot of people would take off the little bulblets. You know, they're kind of like it's going to take a lot of years for them to get up to full size. You can treat those the same way, but I would put them in a little nursery thing instead.
Okay.
And I would just be brave. I'd snap one off. Just take it in your hands. Think of somebody, you know, back in the old prom days or something, and just snap that sucker right off.
Okay.
And be fearless. And I don't think you're going to hurt those two main bulbs, and those are the ones that I would really go after.
Well, I'm really enjoying them. I had another friend who grew them for years and years, and I always admired it, so I'm enjoying them now.
The fun factor for amaryllis is almost unlimited.
Yes.
Good luck with your double amaryllis. I predict great success next season.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the Brandywine 100 Library in North Wilmington, Delaware on Wednesday evening, February 22nd, and at the Capitol Garden Show in Chantilly, Virginia on Saturday and Sunday, February 25th and 26th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with fire ants, possums, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, the curious story of opossums and what they mean when they show up in your garden and landscape. We'll also take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, my good buddy, Howard Garrett, an organic advocate down in Texas who goes by the handle of the Dirt Doctor. Howard, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Glad to be with you.
I'm glad to have you here. You send out a weekly newsletter that touches on a diverse variety of topics, and I always enjoy seeing what you're talking about. I used a little bit of your discussion of sea salt when we did a piece on seaweed a couple of weeks back. But over the holidays, you did a piece on mistletoe, which was I guess, not to be unexpected. Mistletoe is a holiday plant. Now, we all know that mistletoe is toxic. It has a wild history. And as we're getting rid of our Christmas decorations, one of your suggestions was if you had harvested or purchased some mistletoe, to take it and use it to kill fire ants. And that's the reason we're calling you today. I've heard a lot of things in my 30 years in this business, man and boy. I ain't never heard about using Christmas leftovers to kill fire ants.
Well, it's an interesting thing. The fire ant really is pretty easy to control if you just use a little common sense. The organic methods that we have all work to some degree. The only ones that don't work are the toxic chemicals that certain people continue to recommend and use. But yeah, you can chop up mistletoe and sprinkle it over a fire ant. I don't think it kills them. I think it sets up a condition that they don't like. It's kind of like using cinnamon for ants in the house. It'll do the same thing. It runs them off. I think that certain ants just have, it's real easy to antagonize them, and the mistletoe is one of the things that will do it to the fire ants.
Now, would you grind it up? Would you put it in a chipper shredder? Would you just decorate their mound for the holidays?
I've had people tell me that they've had success doing all of the above. Some of them do like I do at my compost pile, chop it up with a machete on top of an old stump and then throw handfuls of it on the mounds and around the mounds. Other people grind it up into a finer powder, and some people have even put it into a 5-gallon bucket and filled it with water and soaked it for 30 minutes or an hour and made a tea and poured it in, and have indicated that that works also.
Any new ideas are always fascinating to me. And fire ants, of course, are fascinating to me from a distance because I am outside of their range. Although I did read a news article a couple of years back that they had been discovered near the boardwalk in Virginia Beach, where my brother lives, which is certainly...
I think they are kind of easing their way farther and farther north in some cases.
And you have native fire ants, don't you, down in the south, down in Texas?
We do have native fire ants, and they're not a problem. They actually help to control a lot of things for us. And the fire ants completely changed how they live. They changed from being one queen per mound and the mounds being territorial to working together much better and having multiple or even hundreds of queens per mound and not particularly worried about other mounds being nearby. That's when we really developed the problem, and the chemicals are what did it.
And you're talking now about the imported fire ant.
And the imported fire ants. Yeah, before, the native fire ants kind of kept them under control. There were some here, but they really weren't a big problem. They only became a problem after we did our assault.
Now, the way I explain fire ants to northerners is imagine an ant mound that, for all intents and purposes, is exactly the same as a yellow jacket nest. You're going to be stung. You're going to be stung repeatedly.
Right.
They like to sting, and they have, my understanding, a very similar venom.
Yeah, they do send out signals once they start biting that alerts the others, and then it becomes a gang attack. And yeah, that's right. The wasps will behave in a similar manner. That's right. One of the things about this idea of using mistletoe is it's just one piece of the puzzle. We, with the organic projects that we have here throughout the South in the zone where things are a lot similar to what I have, very seldom do organic gardeners have problems with the fire ants, because one of the first things we'll do is we'll put out an organic fertilizer that contains sugar as an ingredient, and sometimes we'll put out dry molasses as a fertilizer by itself. And we stumbled into the interesting situation a long time ago on a commercial project that when we do that, most of the time the fire ants leave the property.
Why?
They do not like the increased biological activity
Is that it?
Created.
Because you would expect that they would like sweet stuff, but you're saying it just so greatly improves the soil life that they don't like the neighborhood anymore?
That's right. The first thing, it fires up are the beneficial bacteria, and then right along with them, as that happens, you get protozoa and the beneficial fungi and all those things, and the fire ants are just antagonized by that. They take off.
You know, when you talk about increasing the soil life, I remember years ago I talked to a couple of extension agents from Texas A&M who were the fire ant guys, and they had created a chemical control they called the Texas Two-Step. And very soon after they released that, under a lot of not so much pressure, but people calling them asking for organic alternatives, they came up with the organic Texas Two-Step, which was a combination of D-limaline, which you and I know as Orange Guard and similar products made from orange peels, and spinosads, which is almost itself a biological activity that's formed in the hottest compost piles.
Well, we have a three-step program that we recommend that's a little bit different than that. We recommend this broadcasting of some kind of a sugar, like a dry molasses or a sorghum or something like that, treating the site with beneficial nematodes, which I recommend for all kinds of pest control issues. And then the third thing is drenching the mounds that are left, or if you have any that are specifically bad, with what we call the fire ant mound drench. Is actually a mixture of compost tea, D-limonene or orange oil, and molasses or some sort of sugar. You mix those together and pour it right in the center of the mound so it caves in one spot and gets all the way down to the bottom. And then you slowly cover the entire mound and work your way up, and then you try to pour it finally on those fire ants that are trying to run up your leg. But it works very well. It's not a repellent. It kills them. The D-limonene combined with the longer-lasting sugar and compost tea actually kills them when it contacts them. So there's all kinds of really cool, interesting, organic, safe, soil healthy kinds of things that you can do to get rid of fire ants.
And Howard, remind me now that one of the interesting things about these mounds, especially the old style mounds where there was a single queen, is the worker ants would constantly be moving her around during the time of day, right up to the top of the mound when the sun came up to warm her up, and then deeper into the mound as the day got hotter.
That's right, and people laugh at me sometimes when I talk about needing to be careful when you approach a mound that you're going to treat, because if you go stomping up there and slamming buckets down and things like that, the ants are very smart. They will move the queen into as safe a place, usually deeper, as possible. But if you walk up kind of carefully and quietly and pour the stuff in or put it on the mound, whatever you're doing, you're going to have a lot greater chance of actually getting some of that killing mixture on the queens that way. And, of course, if you do that, the game's over.
The game's over for ants, for termites, for fire ants. I mean, it's like a feminist game of chess. Forget the king. The king is worthless. Get the queen, and the game is over. All right. It is always a pleasure to talk to our good friend Howard Garrett, who preaches the gospel of organics down in Texas. You can learn lots more about Howard and what he does, and I'm sure many of our Southern listeners listen to your show as well as mine. You can find out more about Howard's things at dirtdoctor.com. Dr. Dirt, Howard Garrett, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, man.
Mike, you're the greatest. I appreciate it, and I'll see you soon.
All right, take care, pal.
Bye-bye.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tanya, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello,
thank you,
Tanya.
For having me.
Oh, thank you for being had. Where are you?
I'm in Acton, Ontario, Canada.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Always nice to talk to our Canadian listeners up there. Toronto area is a beautiful area. I visited there many times. What can we do for Tanya near Toronto?
Just before Christmas, we had a huge ice storm, and we received about 3 to 4 inches worth of ice, which heavily damaged a lot of the local trees, my trees being included.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a really nice, healthy red maple in our front yard, and it was probably about 35 feet tall, and it split the trunk. One third of it came off. So two thirds of the tree is still upright, and I have a split tree at the front. And a neighbor of mine, two doors down, had a similar tree, and his trunk split as well. One third of his came off, and he ended up trimming the branches off and sticking the trunk part back together and using his drill and screwing the section of trunk back together. And I'm wondering if that would be worth doing that, or whether it would be best to try to seal the tree, or whether the tree is a lost cause.
Well, boy, I don't want this guy to be the first responder in a car accident. He actually picked up part of a tree that was totally separated and laying on the ground, and and using power equipment, reattached it to the tree. Well, he might qualify as the most hopeful man in North America. There is a system called cabling that when, you know, sometimes you don't even need a storm. Sometimes old trees are just like old people. Their parts start to pull apart. And when it's a famous or historic tree or something that's just beloved by the homeowners, they will hire a certified arborist who will come out and will actually run cables through the tree and sometimes around the tree to hold the parts together. But these are parts that have not completely broken off yet. They've just kind of formed a Y, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I have never heard of Dr. Frankenstein taking parts and sewing them back on after Mother Nature has tossed them aside. So,
well, it's a considerable chunk that came off.
Right.
The length of the chunk was probably a good 8 or 9 feet long.
Right. I think I could be wrong. Miracles happen. I don't think his Tree of the Living Dead, let's call it, I don't think the bolted-on part is going to leaf out in the springtime. Although stranger things have happened. So you have a big honking chunk of your tree laying on the ground.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Now, what about the remaining part of the tree? Typically, when these ice storms occur, they do a lot of damage in the upper canopy that is not that obvious.
The upper part of the canopy, the remaining part of the tree, survived quite well. It's just that one section just came right off.
Okay. And could you live with the tree you have now?
Yes, if it survives.
It's a clean break, right?
Oh, yes. Like it split the trunk.
Right.
One third down, just all the way.
But if you look at one side of the tree, there is continuous bark going from the root system up to the canopy.
Yes, absolutely.
There is no reason the tree will not survive in its current state. You know, one nice thing, Tanya, is it was pruned at exactly the right time of year.
Right before Christmas.
Right. All the leaves were off. It was dormant.
Mm-hmm.
Trees, especially when they're dormant in winter, can lose up to one third of their biomass and not be negatively affected. So it may not have the shape it had before. But I would not suggest you do what he did. Because
would you suggest sealing it with some sort of a paint for trees?
Absolutely not. The studies we have seen, now that used to be the advice, and of course you can go into any garden center and home store and there will be tree sealers and things to, quote, seal your pruning cuts. We now know that Mother Nature handles this much better than anything we could. And there's always the possibility that what you coat the injured part of the tree with will actually prevent the tree from releasing its own natural sealants and healing agents. So my advice is to do nothing and watch how the tree leafs out in the spring And that's going to be your sign of whether any other parts were injured. And then every winter after that, I predict your tree is going to leaf out and the remaining part is going to be just fine, by the way. And then in forthcoming winters, feel free to begin, once all the leaves are off and we're in December, January, February, to either yourself, if you're good at it, or have a trained arborist come around and begin to reshape the remaining tree. So as the years go by, you may actually want to make the tree somewhat smaller in ways, but as you're doing that, make it more symmetrical. So you will have control over the final shape, let's say 7 or 8 years from now.
Okay.
You got to tell us what happens with this guy who bolted his tree together. You got to give us a call.
I will. I'll email you and let you know.
All right, Tanya. Good luck with your tree. I think you'll be fine. We're very curious about his tree of the walking dead. And thanks for calling. It's great to hear from you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the Master Gardener's Spring Symposium in Fayetteville, North Carolina on March 25th and in beautiful State College, PA, April 6th through the 8th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to talk about possums and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Possum from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to a very intriguing question of the week. A listener found holes outside their fence. They know opossums are running around in the area. Did the opossums make the holes? And what do opossums do in the landscape for good and for evil? We'll answer all those questions after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Miguel, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
I'm actually located in Philadelphia.
Okay, well, you know, in Philadelphia, then we got to get a neighborhood out of you.
I actually live not too far from Fairmount Avenue, 19th and 20th Street, a little street called Uver.
Oh, yeah, well, in the Fairmount section of Philadelphia, near the old prison.
Exactly, yes, around there. Well, the question that I have is we kind of put a little bit of sentimental attachment to everything that we have. And you know, when I was getting ready to call, I said, maybe I should not even call me. I should go store and buy a new poinsettia. But the fact is that, you know, we try to rescue these plants that we regularly buy at the store. And the one that we have right now is about 4 or 6 years old. It survived through, you know, like winters and difficult summers. Basically, when we got this plant, it was like a compound of like 6 or 8 little plants. We managed to save these two, and we made it look like a tree almost, like a little tree. It's about 3 to 4 feet tall already.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the yard. The thing is, it has never bloomed, but it was really beautiful during the summer, all green. But then coming winter, we put it into a different pot, and we put it indoors.
Right.
Near a window where we can get some light. But it looks like it's going away. And I said to my wife, let me try to give a Mike a call. Maybe he can have some advice on this. What we notice is that on the soil, there's some, like a little worms. It almost looks like small centipedes, like about 3/4 of an inch long.
Right. They're called millipedes. And they're black and they curl up in a little ball when you touch them.
Yes.
Okay. Now, this thing did not stay outdoors over winter in the past, did it?
No, we never left it outside because
good.
We were afraid that it was not going to make it. I understand that poinsettias are considered summer plants. They're not really winter plants.
They are tropical plants. They are from southern Mexico. You have probably allowed your plants to revert to the true form, which is a small tree or a large bush.
Yes.
The ones that we have are for sale at Christmas time are all heavily pruned to make that very unnatural shape.
Right.
And you probably have been getting flowers, but you haven't known what to look for. When we buy a Christmas poinsettia, let's talk about the basic ones that were some of the leaves are green. And
right.
Then in the center of the plant, is that bright red that everyone calls flowers.
Okay.
Those are not flowers. Those
Ooh, okay.
are specialized leaves called bracts, B-R-A-C-T-S.
Okay.
And they can be made to color up in several different ways, but basically you have to trick the plant into thinking it's back in the tropics. In the very center of that, if you look in the center of the clusters, you'll see little yellow things. The yellow things are what are the flowers.
Okay.
So your thing is struggling now indoors. Is it in a different spot than it has been in previous winters?
Yes, you know what it is. How we started this is we left it on the third floor, which is really not conditioned. It was kind of cool,
mm-hmm.
but it really survived. And we put
right.
it over there every year for the past 3 years. And this year we decided to put it in the living room, which we thought it was better for the plant.
I might move this sucker back upstairs. Now, typically these millipedes are not going to be a huge problem. If you want, you can repot the plant, or you could even water them out and really saturate the soil over and over again.
Okay.
The millipedes will come out. And then you want to allow the soil after that to kind of dry out. Millipedes are creatures of moisture.
Well, my wife was watering it like almost every week. I don't know if that has to do with that. But usually when it was on the third floor, it was just watered like every 2, 2.5 weeks.
And you were really giving the plant a nice rest then.
Oh.
And I think it liked that. So if you don't mind, I'd like to probably hustle this thing back up to the third floor.
I think we'll do it.
Yeah. Now, do you want to know how to get the plant to turn red for you next year?
You know what? I was reading a little bit, and I think it has to do a lot with the lighting.
Yes.
I don't know if that's correct or not. But
yes. What you want to do, beginning 3 months before you want to see the color up,
yes.
What you want to do is you want to get some kind of a very light cloth, but very
okay.
dark, something that lets in no light. And
okay.
every day you wanted to get the brightest light possible. And then every night you wanted to get 12 hours of darkness.
Okay.
So if it's outside, make sure it gets full sun during the day. And then because the city never gets dark at night, there's all street lights, there's all ambient lights, there's moonlit nights. You throw this cover over it and try to do this every night you can. And at the end of 90 days, then you can remove the cover completely and every area of the plant should have where the bracts come out, where the individual definitions of the plant are, so to speak.
Yes.
They should all have that red color towards the center where the yellow flowers appear.
Great. Thank you very much. I think you enlightened my day. Hopefully we can save it. And then if we can, we can give you another shot and see how we did with this.
Yeah, yeah. Color it up for next Christmas.
All right. All right. Well, thanks a lot.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tracy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden. Hi, Tracy.
How are you?
I'm doing good, Trace. How are you?
I'm freezing my bonesies off right now.
Well, you could be anywhere in the country this winter. It has been brutal. Where are you, Trace?
I'm in East Tennessee, Sneebel.
East Tennessee.
I can almost see Kentucky and Virginia from where I am.
Okay, so you're one of our listeners in the Tri-Cities area.
Right.
All right, what can we do for Tracy in Tennessee near the Tri-Cities?
I had a question about my compost. My husband and I have been going round and round. Every time he cleans out the chimney flue, he takes the creosote out and puts it in my compost heap.
What?
And my instincts tell me that that's not a good thing, but he just keeps forgetting and doing it. I just wondered, is it a bad thing?
He keeps forgetting and doing it?
Well, he just forgets that I told him I don't think he ought to do that.
Okay, so is there a hardware store nearby that can make signs for you?
Yes.
You want the sign to say, honey, back off, big letters, maybe in red, and then underneath, see if they can have an image of a 12-gauge shotgun. There's nothing gets a man's attention who knows he's doing something wrong like the image of a shotgun.
Yeah, I see your point.
Now,
so my instincts are right. That's not a good thing.
Oh, my goodness. No, it is possibly the worst thing I've ever heard. Actually, no. Dog and cat feces added to compost can create a terrible immediate health hazard because they can put parasites into the soil that you would then pick up when you work the soil with your hands. That's probably worse. Common mistakes people make are using fireplace ash in their compost pile because it's very alkaline and it upsets the balance.
I do put that in there from my wood stove. I put the wood ashes from my wood stove in there, so I should stop that.
You should stop doing that. Now, you may have noticed that putting the wood ash in a compost pile tends to stop the composting process dead.
I didn't connect the two.
One way to remember what to put into a compost pile and what not is we use the term raw ingredients. So leaves are basically unchanged. We shred them to get them to break up better, but they're basically unchanged. The food we don't eat in the kitchen that gets mixed in there, that's raw. Grass clippings from an untreated lawn, a lawn that hasn't been treated with herbicide, they're raw. But if you think about wood ash, it's already been changed in form. It's already been utilized. Wood is raw, but it takes forever to break down. But wood ashes are actually alkaline. And if you think about out west where the soils are alkaline, nothing grows there. So
okay, well, I'll remember that.
Yeah, they are good for, quote, liming a lawn. That's a great use for them. Unfortunately, the creosote that your husband is getting off the inside of your chimney, it is one of the few substances that scientists agree is a definite carcinogen. It's a definite cause of cancer in humans, which is why creosote is not used in wood preservation anymore.
I see. Okay.
So when he's cleaning the flue, when he's playing chimney sweep, He should be wearing protective gear. He should at least have a dust mask on. And that stuff should be double bagged and gotten rid of legally. That's a very dangerous, toxic substance that has no use in the home or garden.
Okay.
The best thing for compost is a lot of shredded leaves, some coffee grounds, and a little bit of kitchen waste, and you'll go to town.
Okay. And when I clean the chicken house out, I usually put that in there.
Oh, that's great. That's absolutely great. Just make sure it's not too much. As like 20% of a compost pile, it's perfect. And chicken litter and shredded leaves together would make the absolute perfect compost.
Okay.
But we want you to make that sign up.
I will. I'll hustle right over to the hardware store and have them get to work on that.
Honey, back off 12-gauge.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right, Tracy. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, it's time for the question of the week. Do, quote, possums make holes in the ground? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. We heard from Bob and Peg in Locust Grove, Virginia, who write, "We're attaching photos of some holes that we've just noticed the past couple of days. We have a fenced-in yard, and the holes are in the outside of the fence, several holes all along the fence line. Do you know what could be doing this? I know we've had some possums in the yard lately as our dog chases them away frequently. Could they be the culprit? Thanks for any help you can offer." Well, Mike, what help can you offer?
You know, I'm not sure help is necessary here, at least yet. Holes on the outside of a fence are a curiosity, not a problem. And when a dog is roaming inside a fenced-in yard, any holes are likely going to stay on that good side of the fence. I can't think of a single mammal, or marsupial, that's going to try and encroach on a dog's territory.
Okay, then did opossums make those holes? And can I just call them possums?
Not if you want to be technically correct. The only possums are in Australia. The name of the species that's native to the United States is spelled with that O on the front. But Webster says it's pronounced opossum, as if the O were a short A.
And does anyone in the United States say it that way?
Yeah, probably just zookeepers, researchers, and the members of the National Opossum Society, which has a great series of informational web pages about these weird little creatures, and tries to help people who find injured or abandoned ones.
Okay. Did opossums make these holes?
Probably not. These creatures are mostly arboreal and prefer to live in trees, on the limbs in the summer, and inside holes and cavities in the winter. But they will use burrows that other creatures have dug in the ground.
So are the opossum sightings at least connected to these holes?
That depends to some degree on whether these holes are really new. If they're old burrows, then it makes perfect sense that the possums...
Wait, you didn't use the right word!
Hey, you know I'm dyslexic, and the proper name of this creature is the kind of letter combination that makes people like me need to sit down and tell a written word to behave for a while. Anyway, if opossums were trying to get at something tasty, like spilled seed from a bird feeder or trash in a plastic bag as opposed to a sealed container, but they got startled by a dog, they would almost certainly run right into a nearby burrow to hide.
But they wouldn't dig the burrow.
No, they're climbers that don't dig big holes. My best guess, if the holes are shallow, is that they were made by skunks digging for worms or grubs. If the holes lead to actual big tunnels, then it's probably groundhogs.
Wouldn't groundhogs chase off possums?
Maybe, if the woodchucks were right there and paying attention, but they might be asleep or in another run. Or they may have started to dig one of their extensive subway systems and then got scared off by that dog. Or they could even have been on the losing end of a Darwinian struggle. The research I found says that possums can be pretty fierce when necessary. So they could have fought off a groundhog or two, maybe even eaten one. Several sources report that opossums are great predators of roof rats.
Roof rats?
Yeah, really nasty and dangerous things. Rats that climb up on a roof and then get into the house that way. And any creature that takes out a rat is a good friend of mine, no matter how weird they look.
Are possums considered to be garden pests?
Yeah, theoretically they could be, but they're not strict vegetarians. They're omnivores that also eat a lot of pests, like roaches, slugs, snails, mice, and rats. They will go after fruits, but most of the good sources specify they prefer, quote, overripe fruit. So they're more likely to eat dropped peaches or tomatoes than ones that are actively growing.
You live in a very rural area and have big gardens. Do you see a lot of possums?
No, but I'm also not outside at 2 a.m. when these nocturnal marsupials would be most active. I do know we have a lot of them in the area. I see lots of them when I'm driving home after dark. But evil squirrels, raccoons, and groundhogs are much bigger threats to my garden. And now that I know that possums eat slugs and rats, I may learn to love my weird little marsupials.
What about people who might prefer to, well, love them from afar?
The National Opossum Society says if you want to keep these creatures at a distance, to keep your trash and garbage in sealed containers, don't feed seed to birds. That spilled seed also attracts the much more dangerous mice and rats. Don't leave any pet food outside. And chill. Opossums are our only native marsupial. And once again, if they eat dangerous and destructive creatures like slugs, snails, mice, and rats, they can wander through my garden anytime they want. Well, that sure was some interesting information about opossums now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to poach my possums if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And you know what I'm going to say? If you do send us an email, please, please, please tell us where you live. Please, oh, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Adam Stanishevsky. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm Marsupial Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. Is it safe to plant anew where a tree has recently died? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what to do with a space whose former occupant is dearly departed. Plus your fabulous phone calls.